I'm just going to offer a word of thanks, Peggy and Mindy, for all that you do. Choir, for what you do. Ray, thanks for your help and leadership. There's folks at the soundboard. There's folks teaching in Rock City. There's folks greeting at the door. I have realized this week, maybe more poignantly than at other times, what a gift and a grace it is to share leadership and ministry together. And maybe that's been especially true for me this week with Charles on vacation. And he is still on vacation this morning and hopefully having a really great and relaxing time away. We're in Matthew 25 today, and so I'm going to invite you to turn there if you want to grab a Bible. The words will be on the screen as well, so we can follow. You can follow along there too. We're going to start in verse 31 in Matthew 25, and we'll read through verse 46 this morning. Hear the word of the Lord. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, "Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." And the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry, gave you food, or thirsty, and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me." Then he will say to those at his left hand, "You that are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not give me clothing. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they also will answer, "Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not take care of you?" Then he will answer them, "Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it for one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Grateful that Charles left me with a doozy this morning. In 2006, the Ohio State football team, I'm making an assumption they won last night. Is that a correct assumption? I turned it off at halftime. I didn't even think to look this morning. But in 2006, Ohio State played Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl. I don't know if anybody remembers that game. It was a big game. Two powerhouse schools. Both teams have a strong national following. I mean, you can go just about anywhere in the country, and you've got folks who say OH. They'll say IO. And other folks who are big Notre Dame fans all over the place. And they were both, I think, in that year ranked in the top five in the country. Talented players on both sides, guys who were going to end up playing professionally in the NFL. And I happened to be watching that game with a group of friends who were avid Ohio State fans and who had just purchased a large, high-definition television. And I mean, that was when, I mean, now we're used to high definition on our telephones. But you know, back then, an HD TV was like the new thing. And so we're watching, I don't even know how much they spent on that stinking TV. But if I was glad to go over and watch the game on it. And so we're watching the game, and we're just like marveling at the picture quality of this TV. I mean, now we'd probably laugh about that, but then it was like, man, this is incredible. And we were making comments about how I think we can even see the like stitching, you know, on the players' jerseys. And there happened to be one person at that game who had some extra stitching, some extra like hand-done stitching on her jersey. She was the sister of Notre Dame's quarterback, and the serious girlfriend, later wife, of Ohio State star linebacker. And she got a lot of airtime in that game. I've actually got a picture. So there she is. And her extra stitching was because she was wearing a half Notre Dame, half Ohio State jersey. I think this kind of prompted a lot of airtime on TV. Right, and the obvious question that she was asked like over and over again by TV reporters and newspaper journalists, I saw a New York Times article that I dug out. You know, Google, you can find a whole lot of things. And that they had been asking her about this, and I'm sure there were lots of other folks as well, right? The question was this: who are you rooting for? Right? Which side are you on? And in the interviews, I mean, she did this really, like, admirable job of, like, remaining neutral, like, of walking that thin line between boyfriend and brother. But that didn't keep people from asking that question repeatedly. And it didn't keep people from making assumptions or suggestions as to which side or the other she should be leaning towards. And as I watch this, like, playing out, on national television, I remember thinking at that time, like, man, we live in a culture that is obsessed with picking sides, right? With, like, choosing a team, right? I'm for this side, and I'm against that side. And we can certainly have some lighthearted fun with that, right? I mean, I'm just as bad as anyone else about giving our Michigan fans a hard time or our Penn State fans a hard time, especially when OSU whoops them. Just going to throw that in. I'm going to hear about that later. But inevitably, when there's winners and there's losers, picking sides could lead us to elation if we feel as though our team won, or to despair, right, if we lost, and all because we chose a side. Jesus tells one last parable in Matthew 25. So it's his final one in Matthew's account of Jesus' life, and it marks the conclusion of this last great, they call them the great discourses of Jesus, so these kind of chunks of teaching that appear in Matthew's gospel. And this is the end of the final one, and in some ways it has kind of a different style than most of Jesus' parables and stories, but as with all parables, it's a story that's not primarily intended to be read literally, right? So similar to the story of the debtor and lender that we were looking at last week, or the two sons who were asked about working in the vineyard the week before that, right? It's a story with a deeper meaning or meanings, a story that reveals or unveils a truth that is bigger than the story itself. When we first read this parable in Matthew 25, I think we may find ourselves picking sides, right? Like identifying ourselves or identifying others with one team or the other, right? With the sheep or the goats, the ones at the right, the ones at the left. And depending on our self-designation or our designation of others, Lord help us, we may walk away from this text with our chest puffed up a little bit and our head held high, kind of an inflated sense of self-assurance. I'm totally a sheep. Or we may walk away from it feeling dejected, downtrodden, overwhelmed by a sense of somehow needing to do better, right? Nothing but a goat. But I think if we read more carefully, we'll realize that may well not be what Jesus is really, really getting at. In Jesus' story, both those on the king's right and those on the king's left are surprised. They're caught off guard by the king's verdict. And both groups essentially respond to the king with the same question, right? Like, Lord, when was it? When was it that we saw you? When was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or sick or in prison, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and did or did not take care of you? And what's evident in their question on both sides is that their acts of compassion or lack thereof, were not motivated by what they stood to gain or lose by them. Right? What they had done or not done was done without any like comprehension of who they were in essence doing it for. They didn't have an ulterior motive. They didn't do what they did or not do what they didn't do because the person or people who were hungry or thirsty or naked or stranger were in some sense in their minds as Jesus, and they, you know, knew that to be the case or were responding as if that were indeed the case. Right? They weren't doing it because they knew the king was watching and sensed that there was some reward to be gained by what they did. I think it could be said that what they did what they did or didn't do what they didn't do simply because it was who they were. It was an overflow of their heart on one hand for the sake of another or the other, and an overflow of the heart on the other side for the sake of self-interest. You know, I think of the story of that Jesus told about the injured man on the roadside, right? That we often refer to as the parable of the Good Samaritan. And right, so this man is injured on the side of the road, and he's bypassed by those who were kind of considered to be the insiders, and then is assisted, right, by an outsider, kind of an unlikely candidate who might not have matched the like proper, you know, religious profile, but who lived compassionately. I think that the real question that Jesus, by means of this parable in Matthew 25, is inviting us to ask ourselves, may not be, right, maybe is not, right, which side am I on, or how can I maybe switch sides, because eternal fire doesn't sound very sweet. Or the question, how can I do better? But I wonder if Jesus is inviting us, rather beckoning us to consider the question with this parable, where is my heart? Who am I? And how does that come out, right? In the way in which I'm living my life. Earlier in Matthew's gospel, Jesus says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And, you know, these acts of compassion or lack thereof, kind of lived out by those who are gathered around the king in this story, they reveal something about, right, our hearts. They reveal something about what we treasure. Do we treasure the good of others with no strings attached, no ulterior motive, nothing to be gained by it, or do we treasure what's convenient, what's expedient, what's beneficial, maybe momentarily beneficial, but beneficial to us in some way? I think what we do reveals what we treasure, right? What we value most. And what we value most reveals what's really inside, right? What's in our hearts. Jesus' invitation throughout his earthly ministry was to treasure God, right? To love God with all of our being, with our heart, our soul, our mind, our strength. To treasure others, right? To love our neighbor. Not because we have something to gain by doing that. Though certainly it is a blessing, right, to love our neighbor. But not because we have something to be gained by it, but simply because they're worthy of our love as a child of God. That seems to be at the very heart of this parable. And in light of that, I think we ought not just read it as an encouragement to somehow do differently, but rather as an invitation for us to consider how with God's help we might desire differently. Like to care about the things that God cares about, to love the things that God loves, to have a perspective that's eternal if our focus is solely on the external stuff, the what we do, you know, kind of stuff, I think we're just going to find ourselves in this like rat race of trying to do better, of wondering if it's good enough, questioning along the way if whether our motives are actually really like pure or not, and you know, probably ending up either falsely elated because we think too highly of ourselves, or falsely deflated because we think too little of ourselves. We'll agonize over, you know, what kind of side we're on, and we'll fall into like making assumptions, right, about ourselves or about others, and you know, that's not really good news, and it's not the good news that Jesus came to bring either. In fact, I think that's the very mindset that Jesus was really dismantling with his life and his ministry and his care for others and his death and his resurrection. Jesus was, and I believe is, inviting us to, in this parable, to consider the deeper parts of ourselves, not just the external things. To consider what's inside, and also inviting us to think about how we might treasure something different. Like to treasure God for God's sake, to treasure our neighbor for their sake and for God's sake, to treasure the kingdom. And there our heart will be also. And out of that, right, from that place, we'll do what we do. Not for gain, not for brownie points with the king, but simply it's because it's who we are and who we're becoming by the grace of God. And we can really only get to that place, we can only move in that direction by surrendering. Right? Not by trying, but by yielding. There's a quote that I've had for the last couple weeks at the... So Gmail allows you to put a signature at the bottom of an email. Is this a familiar thing? So basically it shows up like automatically whenever you send an email. You don't have to like put it in there every time. It just shows up. And so I've gotten into this habit and pattern of either putting like a Bible verse that's been on my mind or a quote that I've seen. That, you know, and oftentimes I'll put it there not for the sake of like trying to like teach others by it as I send an email, but really because every time I send an email, then I see it. And so it's this like great reminder for me, because every time I send it, it's right there. But the quote that's been there for the last couple weeks is this: becoming more like Jesus is not a matter of trying, but of yielding, setting the sails of our lives to catch the wind of the Spirit. Jesus frames the story that he tells in Matthew 25, in this part that we read today, within the context of final judgment, right? Undoubtedly, these are matters of eternal significance that Jesus is talking about. In certain ways, the parable mirrors other apocalyptic writing that we find in the Bible. I know, a big seminary word. Every once in a while, I have to throw those out to make you guys think I'm smarter than I actually am. So I felt like this would be a good opportunity to do that. But apocalyptic writing, so it's similar to what we find in the, if you've read some of the prophecy of Daniel in the Old Testament, or in the book of Revelation as well. So they're writings that present a vision of the end, right, of what will be. And sometimes they may seem like a kind of harsh vision of the end. But they're written really with the intent of encouraging the faithful. So that's the audience for the apocalyptic writing. They're writing to the faithful to encourage the faithful to live well, to live faithfully in the present. Right? They're a declaration that in the end, God will set all things right. And that inevitably involves judgment against that which is not right, so that which is not in line with God's will and God's intentions for the world. They're declarations that the all-pervasive goodness that marked the beginning of creation, that it's going to be restored. They're also declarations that in the meantime, that vision of what will be has implications for our life right here and right now. And that it's those right here and right now things that really underlie the intent and the purpose of the apocalyptic writing in the first place. Jesus is telling this parable to his disciples in a private conversation with them. Right, so that's his audience. His audience is his disciples. There are times when Jesus used parables in order to speak like kind of against people in a certain way. We see an example of that a few chapters earlier in Matthew 21, where the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they realize like, oh man, Jesus is telling that story about us. You know, man, how dare he do that? So there's times where Jesus does use stories and parables in that way, but not here. Right here, he's talking to his disciples. Here, his audience is those who are faithfully following him. Jesus is talking with the faithful, encouraging the faithful to remember who they are. Not just to remember who they will be, but who they are now. And to realize how much that matters. There are so many things in the world that are trying to convince us of who we are, right? That are competing for our allegiance, that are competing for us to treasure them. And I would say, as much as I love sports, that affiliation with sports teams might be among them. There are many and varied factors that contribute to our sense of self-identity that make up our understanding of who we are. But Jesus invites us over and over again, and I think here as well in Matthew 25, to consider our core identity. Right? If we peel back all the other layers, what is it that we find at the center of who we are and who we understand ourselves to be? And that's something that the biblical authors often use the word heart to talk about. What is it that forms the core of who we are, the core of who we understand ourselves, or how we understand ourselves, and how is that then revealed in the manner in which we live our lives? Right? If our core identity is being an Ohio State fan, that might look something like this. You can flip that picture, Anna. I'm not trying to throw those guys under the bus. They just set themselves up to be a really great example, right? If that's our core identity, it might end up looking something like this in our life. If our core identity is really caught up in what we do for a living, right, it's going to show in our dedication to whatever that is, to the neglect of other things and other relationships. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be dedicated to what we do for work, but if that's our core identity, right, we're gonna see that in our lives. And if our core identity is knowing ourselves to be loved by God, right, who has given us life, who sustains us by his gracious provision, who has redeemed us from our own self-will and from the power of sin and death, right, if that's our true identity, and if we welcome and embrace that, being loved by God, loving God in return, if we embrace that as our core identity, as the center of who we are, right, then it's gonna show forth. It's gonna come out, Jesus tells us, in our love for other people, particularly those who are most in need of our love. And it's those folks kind of on the, I guess you could say, on the margins, the hungry, the thirsty, the poor, the stranger or immigrant, the sick, the incarcerated, who Jesus in this parable identifies himself with. Right? And I think we do well to not forget at what moment it is that Jesus tells this story to his disciples. Right after this, like in the verses just following where we read today, Jesus tells his disciples that 2 days later, Jesus has predicted his death and told his disciples about it coming, but it's always been kind of this, like, after he tells this story, he tells the disciples, it's just 2 days now. It's 2 days. And Jesus is going to be handed over to be crucified. Right? Soon, Peter, James, and John, and all the rest, right, they are going to be without their leader and without their Lord. Their love for God has taken on flesh in their commitment, like, to literally follow Jesus. And now, right, or very soon, as the case is, Jesus would not be with them in the same way. Yet in this final story, he invites his disciples to still see him. But to see him in the hungry and the thirsty and the poor and the immigrant and the sick and the incarcerated. What Mother Teresa called Jesus in his most distressing disguise. Maybe it's as sort of as if Jesus were saying, you know, it's not that I won't be there with you anymore. You might just have to look in places and among people whom you might not expect to find me. Brandon Vogt, I'm probably pronouncing his last name wrong, is a Christian writer, and he said this. He said, Jesus is fond of his most distressing disguise, and that is where we should look for him. Apocalyptic writing declares that the world will be turned upside down in God's final victory. And using an apocalyptic kind of story, Jesus invites his disciples then and now to live as though the world has already turned. You know, as I place myself, as I find myself in this parable, which is part of what parables invite us to do. They invite us to find ourselves in the story. And as I find myself in this story, I certainly see within myself some sheepness and some goatness. Right, I can relate to the imagery of the half and half jersey. And I can see that in my own heart, and I see it revealed in my life. You know, there are sometimes where I find myself living from a place that feels somewhat selfless. We have to be careful, I think, there. Pride can creep in there too. But there are other times where like I find myself like totally living selfishly, right? Like totally committed to my own agenda and my own will and my own desires, sometimes without fully even realizing like what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. Martin Luther, the 16th century Protestant reformer, he once described Christians as simultaneously saints and sinners, right? We wear both jerseys. At the same time. But that's not to say that we're not moving. It's not to say that we're not on a journey, a gracious journey, a journey that progresses through yielding as opposed to trying, a journey from one to the other. All right, not overly deflated by the one to the point of despair, not overly inflated by the other to the point of pride, but acknowledging both with humility and also with a trust in what God can do in us and what God can do through us when we set the sails of our lives to catch the wind of the Spirit and allow him to gently and slowly, man, it's a lifelong journey, to gently and slowly carry us from one shore to the other, both now and also for all eternity. Will you pray with me? God, you have showered us with your compassion and your love, even when we may be reluctant to realize it. God, in the midst of so many voices that call out to us, you have told us who we truly are. Help us to embrace our true identity in you as your beloved children, and as those through whom your love is made manifest in the world, particularly in the lives of those who represent you in your most distressing disguise. Help us to recognize you in that most distressing disguise. And we ask that the wind of your Spirit may carry us on that journey of growing into the likeness of Jesus, and also of seeing the likeness of Jesus in others. A journey toward maturity, a journey toward what we might say, as we're in the midst of this adulting series, spiritual adultness. Carry us in that direction, O God, as we yield ourselves and our lives to you. We ask this in your name, Jesus, and for the sake of your glory.